Hello everyone, welcome to the Deep Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ross Edwards, and today we're continuing on with our April series on the philosophy of science. And today we're diving into the bias towards models and explanations that exists within science. We're going to look at how this bias towards wanting to put names to things, to explain things, to model things, to give reasons for things, is actually very problematic, and how it constitutes a fundamental bias in science. Before we get into the main episode, I just want to say that I have new long-form episodes every Wednesday and snippets on Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday, always at 9 p.m. Central European Time, 8 p.m. UK Time and 3 p.m. Eastern Time if you're in the States. Make sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And a quick mention that you can stay up to date with my latest episodes and projects via my newsletter. There's a link in the description to that. And you can also find my books there as well. So let's get into the heart of this episode. And this is just, again, it's building on the kind of theme that we've been exploring this month, which is on the philosophy of science. And really what I've been doing is exposing a lot of the biases that exist within science. And this is yet another one. It's the bias to model things, to explain everything, to find the explanation for things. And this, it's really quite obvious when you think of it. This underlies much of science, because really, science is about making models. It's about making descriptive frameworks of reality, whether that's biology or chemistry or physics or neuroscience or any other scientific field. It's all about modeling things and finding explanations. And if you look at science, the theories, the laws, the discoveries, what are all these things? Think of Isaac Newton, think of Albert Einstein, Stephen Hawking, Richard Feynman, think of Maxwell and the laws of electromagnetism, and think of all the great scientific discoveries. What are all of these things? And you might say, well, they're discoveries about the workings of reality. They are works of genius that describe and reveal how our world works. Okay, what I want to propose is that these things are all actually models, and these people, these scientists, they're all model builders. Now, as I'll talk about much more as we go on here, the fact that they are models is both a blessing and a curse. And a lot of the things I'll be saying will be talking about how they are a curse, because that's really my focus this month. But it doesn't need to be a curse, but when we don't realize that these things are models, that's when we fall into trouble. So what is a model? Because if we're going to spend the next half an hour or 60 minutes talking about models, well, we must have to describe what a model is. So a model is just a set of observations or propositions that attempt to describe a phenomenon. It's very, very broad. And it doesn't have to necessarily even be a strictly scientific thing. Of course, in psychology, there are models. Even in spiritual practice, there are models, because if we are trying to describe a phenomenon like enlightenment, well, anything we use to describe it or any way we attempt to describe how one reaches that is a model. It's a set of observations or propositions. So you can think of a model as like a set of descriptions or a set of ideas that describe something. Very, very broad. So for example, right, Einstein's laws of relativity, and even if you don't know what the laws of relativity are, you know, in a mathematical sense, I'm sure you've heard of Einstein's laws of relativity because they're sort of famous scientific model. These laws are an attempt to explain how space and time work relative to objects moving at high speed. So the laws that Einstein came up with are a set of propositions about objects, about things moving at high speed, whether it's planets or a particle or any object. So it's about something. The laws are about something. They are a description of something. Now, this is where we start to even touch on one of the main flaws of models. And it's a really obvious limitation, but it's one that we often don't think about, especially scientists, and especially when you are in a rational stage of development, you often don't think about these things. You don't realize that this is the case. You just believe that laws are describing reality as it is. Here's the key thing about them. Well, here's one simple but very important critique, is that a model is always about a phenomenon. Therefore, by definition, it is not the phenomenon itself. So Einstein's laws of relativity are sets of descriptions, mathematical descriptions about how objects move. It's not the object moving itself, is it? Of course it's not, because we're talking about the laws of relativity. We're not talking about the objects themselves. You might say, well, we're describing the movement, and we can only do that through mathematics and physics. Well, yeah, but you're still saying I am describing the movement, and to describe is to make a description about something. You see, the keyword is about. It's about something. It's one thing related to another thing. It's something that is pointing to something else. So it's a law pointing to the movement or describing the movement. It's not the movement itself. It never is. By definition, you know, Einstein's laws of relativity are essentially just equations on a piece of paper or a screen or in a book or whatever, right? It's not an object. It never is, and it never was, you see? So it's such an obvious thing, but it just shows you one of the main limitations is a model never actually describes a phenomenon accurately, because the only thing that can quote unquote describe something accurately is the phenomenon itself. And the phenomenon itself is not a model, it's just the phenomenon, right? And fundamentally, here's a deeper point, that phenomena in the world, fundamentally you cannot describe them, right? For example, right, you might, let's say that the device that you're listening to this on, you can think of that as a phenomenon. You know, it's you're seeing it, you're holding it, you're interacting with it. It's a thing, it's an object, it's a phenomenon. It's like a phenomenon in our world, right? Or in your world. But listen, if I didn't know what a mobile phone was or a laptop was or however you're listening to this, you could not describe that to me in a way such that I would be able to imagine what it is without other references. You say, well, it's an iPhone, right? But if I already know what an iPhone is, then I've already seen it, you know, I've already experienced it for myself. But without that, without the reference to a prior experience, if you just say it's an iPhone, well, I've no idea what that is. And you describe what an iPhone is, and you describe the color and the shape and the size. There's only so much you can do, right? And that's a simple example, but it's the same as happening all the time in human life and all over the place. Try and describe what a banana tastes like. Try and describe what a sunset looks like. I used these examples last week. you can't, there comes a point where you can't describe them, and you inevitably have to just say, well, it tastes as it tastes, because I can't describe it to you. What I'm claiming is that all phenomena are actually like that, because there's just words just do not have the power to describe how phenomena are. And so clearly, models never describe reality. I mean, there are obviously better and worse ways to describe something. Like if you tell me a banana is the color blue, maybe there are blue bananas in the world, but I've never seen one. If you tell me a banana is blue and you tell me it tastes like, I don't know, peanuts, well, you're not doing a very good job with your description. Obviously, there's better descriptions, but even the best descriptions fall short. There's always a gap between concepts and reality. And I hope this seems simple to you. It seems really simple and obvious to me. And I don't mean that to boast. I just mean because it's a fundamental limitation of concepts. It's just part of what a concept is. It's always about something else. It's never the thing itself. And this might seem trivial, but imagine not knowing the difference between the word banana and an actual banana. And you might believe, well, if someone just says the word banana to me, that means I'm eating a banana. It's the same as eating a banana. So I'm, you know, if someone says the word banana 10 times, I've eaten 10 bananas, right? That's obviously not the case. So we need to be able to distinguish concept from reality at the most basic level. But listen, in science, this often does not happen. We often fail to distinguish concept from reality. We fail to distinguish a model from the reality of the thing. You know, we say, well, the laws of relativity, this and that and next thing, we pretend that they actually describe objects faithfully. And I'm not saying that they're wrong and they're not useful, but fundamentally they are limited. And it's not because Einstein wasn't a good physicist. it's just the nature of concepts and descriptions is that they can never describe things. Now listen, the whole of science, that is what it is. It's a conceptual system. So it never actually captures reality. And this, scientists do not understand this and they do not recognize this because they fuse reality with concept all the time. And sometimes this might not be such a big problem, but in certain areas it's a huge problem. So let's get into the real key points of this episode today, the heart of it. Here's a really important thing, and this is very much related to models because it shows you how models are constructed and to what end. What we tend to assume as humans is that if we observe something, there has to be a cause to it. There has to be a first cause behind it. And then what we do is, not only that, we assume that the first cause is more real than the phenomenon itself. If this sounds very abstract, we're going to look at an example, so just hold on. So for example, if we observe X to happen and we find out that Y causes it, then we say that X is happening because of Y, or Y is the cause of X. You see, this is a bias. You know, it's biasing the cause over the effect. It's biasing what is observed before something happens to the phenomenon itself, right? This is fundamental to understanding how models work and what their limits are, because often the goal in scientific models is to model that first cause. You know, even Einstein was modeling a first cause because he was saying, well, an object moving at high speed, the mass changes and how the how it relates to time between observers. Listen, I'm not a huge physics expert, but I know enough to tell you what I'm saying right now. The effects observed to that object, they are caused by space-time warping, or however he described it, right? So they are modeling the first cause, right? Now, obviously, you can calculate things directly about the mass and the velocity but fundamentally, it's basing everything on the fact that space and time aren't givens, right? So it's always like this step back is happening all the time. It's the phenomenon isn't enough in and of itself. We have to look for the cause behind it, right? So for example, let me give you a really concrete, obvious example. This is one we looked at last week when we were talking about why correlation is not explanation and the limitations this causes in brain science. But let's take the example of fear. So the way we usually look at fear is that fear is caused by something on a biological or neurological level. So let's say you get scared by a spider. Our usual explanation is, well, it's because there's brain activity, there's neurological activity, your amygdala is lighting up, and then there's a cascade of effects through the nervous system. So it's not just that we observe that there's simultaneous brain activity. What we often say is that we experience fear because of the brain activity, because of the thing that is behind the scenes. Notice that brain activity is invisible, and it's only detectable to brain imaging machinery and so on. To the human eye and to our ordinary perception, it is invisible. And science loves this stuff. Science loves invisible causes, invisible things that it can then say is the first cause, right? And then, or it's also behind the scenes, because looking at you, if you're scared, I can't see your brain activity. I can only see the effects of fear on you, right? That's all I can see. I can't see your brain activity. I can't even see your brain. So it's behind the scenes. And again, this is a huge bias in models. If you study science to any level, this is what science is doing all the time. It's putting the cause of things on things that we can't see or that are behind the original phenomenon, right? With the example of fear, we could say, well, brain activity causes the fear. Therefore, if we just model brain activity and we understand brain activity and we can change brain activity through drugs or through stimulating the brain regions, that's it. We've conquered fear forever. You see I don't know, if you can see the limitation of that, I really hope you do. That is a bias, you see, because as I spoke about last week in my episode last Wednesday on the 8th of April, you see that we never, drawing a causative relationship between the brain activity and fear is a bias. It's a scientific bias. All we actually have is that the brain is activating and at the same time we feel fear, or not at the same time necessarily, but there's a relationship between the two. We never actually observe causation, but it's a scientific bias to draw causation from that, to conclude that brain activity is causing us to be scared. And this is just happening in models all the time. So this is very useful, right? It's useful to look for first causes. And it's been hugely profitable. This bias towards first causes has probably been what's propelled science forward. But it's problematic. And demanding explanation for things, demanding an explanation for why do we feel fear? Why do we feel fear? That itself is a bias. That's an assumption. We assume that there is a cause, and we want to find out what that cause is. What if there isn't a cause? You know, what if we actually cannot understand that fundamentally? Like, on, we might be able to superficially draw conclusions about brain activity and so on, but what if fundamentally we actually don't know how fear works? And I'm not saying we should just, we should accept ignorance and accept not having explanations as like a passive kind of stance or as like a kind of resignation. What I'm saying is when you open that yourself to the possibility and you see that fundamentally what we're looking for is explanation, and you ask, well, is that the right question to ask? Is that a bias? Is that like, is that actually creating more problems than it's solving? Then you can say, well, it opens you up. And then any subsequent reasons you might give for why we feel fear, for example, this can apply to anything, but just for example, those subsequent conclusions are likely to be more they're better reasoned and less subject to bias and less subject to like scientific dogma and typically scientific ways of interpreting things. And also, just because we might reject an explanation for something, it doesn't mean we need to replace it with another thing. We might find that maybe the brain doesn't actually cause fear. And then, of course, we ask, well, what does cause fear? And that's our natural instinct. But again, what if we're jumping the gun? What if we need to really look at deeper assumptions about how life works before we start looking, basing ourselves on other assumptions that might themselves be erroneous, trying to find an answer, is to sit back and consider more carefully what are we asking? Why are we asking it? Right? That is like, this is real inquiry. You see, putting things to a first cause, like an invisible first cause, like brain activity, that is not real inquiry. That is working within the scientific paradigm and applying it to new phenomena and then immediately assuming that those new phenomena can be understood through that paradigm. But what if they can't? And that is, I'm not saying that that's the only thing we need to do to inquire, but at least we're seeing those assumptions in that paradigm, right? So let's get into the main critiques of models and explanations here. For one thing, the desire, the act of building a model already introduces bias. For example, models impose variables on things. And when we impose variables, usually we're trying to impose independent variables for so many reasons. And again, you see that this is the more we conceptualize things, the further we are getting away from reality, the further we're getting away from the actual phenomenon itself, and the further we removed we are from actually seeing things as they are, right? And again, our variables and our concepts might be useful, but what if they're not? What if we're actually just tying ourselves in knots here? And again, variables are a very subjective thing because you choose variables according to what you think is important. You know, one variable might be, well, brain activity. One variable might be, what is the thing the person is getting scared of? Another variable might be, you know, how much time are they exposed to it for? You see, it's breaking things down into very kind of rigid and chunky categories, you see? And again, that might be useful, but again, it might be a huge bias and a result of our own limited thinking. As I've said, models tend to favour hidden mechanisms. Let me explain another side of this that I haven't looked at yet. What you'll notice if you study science is it's very, very hesitant to assign reality to anything. Like, it's very reluctant to say, this thing stands on its own and it doesn't need an explanation behind it. And it's not only that, it tends to assign reality to parts of things rather than wholes of things. For example, right? Science has a hard time assigning reality to just a human being. What science will tend to do is it'll say, well, what is a human being? Oh, well, a human being is just cells. Really, you know, when we break it down, that's all it is, you know. The skin is made of cells, the face is made of cells, the eyes are made of cells, the brain is made of cells, even the bones are made of cells, you see. And then they'll go another step and you say, well, what are the cells made of? You know, we've spoken about the human being, and a human being, it seems like this, you know, elaborate, complex, almost really too complicated to understand, this thing. When we can break it down into cells. What about a cell? You know, a cell, if you look under a microscope at a cell, looks like this amazingly complex thing, but, well, if we can do that with a human, why not do it with a cell? Because a cell isn't as complicated as a human. So let's break a cell down. We find its molecules of all kinds. And then, well, what are molecules? Oh, well, they're all just, you know, fundamentally, molecules are just constituted from the periodic table of elements. And then what we've done is we've broken the human down into cells, we've broken down into molecules, and we've broken down into the elements, the chemical elements. And we'd say, well, the human being really is just the chemical elements. And then we can say, well, what is an element? You know, what is an atom? What is a carbon atom? What is a carbon atom? And we look at that, and what we've discovered in the last kind of 100 years of physics is atoms are mostly nothing, like nothing at all, not even air nothing, you know, not like how what's inside a balloon is really nothing. No, what's inside a balloon is air. The actual, you know, the substance of a carbon atom is mostly nothing. Like, the volume of a carbon atom is mostly just nothing, nothingness. So we could say, well, the human being is just nothingness, because the human being is just cells, and then the cells are just molecules, and the molecules are just composed of different atoms, and all atoms are mostly empty space. So the human is mostly empty space. Now, on one level, that is true, but on another level, clearly a human is not just empty space. I mean, come on. Like, even the most rigid scientist doesn't relate to other people, and certainly not to themselves, as though they were just empty space. They don't. Like, how would you relate to someone if you really genuinely believed they were empty space? Like, you really felt down to the marrow of your bones that they were empty space? Well, you probably wouldn't speak to them, you probably wouldn't love them, you probably wouldn't interact with them, because you don't sit and talk to the air inside a balloon, do you? Well, you might, but most people don't. You see that that's the gap, you know, when we reduce things down, we think, oh, well, we're analysing, we're parsing it, we're understanding it more deeply, you know, we're getting to the constituent elements, and therefore, because we're getting to the constituent elements, then we're understanding the human, and we have a good model of the human. But no, because your fucking model is that the human is empty space. That's what it basically boils down to. So clearly that's not a good model, because you don't, as a scientist, you don't relate to other people as though they're empty space. You don't. So that's like, I mean, that's another problem, the problem between the gap between concept and reality, which we've spoken about. But it's the problem of thinking that because we look at the hidden, you know, what's hidden, what is hidden within things, you know, cells are hidden within the human, and then molecules are hidden within the cell, and then atoms are hidden within the molecule, and so on. We think that we're understanding the thing better, but actually, no, We're just becoming more and more removed from the actual thing itself. This is exactly what I'm talking about. The scientist will not assign reality to a human. It doesn't. It always wants to break it down. It wants to break the human down into atoms. But there's a huge problem with this, and it's so like glaringly obvious. I don't understand how scientists don't see it. Like, I really don't understand. It's an endless regress problem. Typical philosophical problem that's more general than the example I'm giving, right? But listen, it's just a recursive problem. If you say A isn't real, but the constituent parts of A, which are called B, those are real. But B has constituent parts. So the constituent parts of B, which are called C, are real. But C has constituent parts. But D has constituent parts. But E has constituent parts. But everything has constituent parts. You see? So you could say, well, what? Nothing is real because I can't assign reality to anything. Because even, for example, atoms, I can't assign a reality to an atom because we know that the atoms are made of subatomic particles as well. You know, atoms are made of protons and neutrons and electrons, and then those are made of the even wackier things than that, you see? It's like when you cannot assign reality to anything and you have to go a level deeper every single time, your whole thing will collapse eventually. And you might say, well, oh, but if we reach the Planck length... If you don't know what the Planck length is, you can look it up or you can listen to me when I say that. There is, if you think about like pixels on a screen, that fundamentally, you know, the smallest resolution on a screen is determined by the length of the size of a pixel on the screen or the number of pixels. Same thing, according to science, the same thing is happening at the level of physical reality, that fundamentally, there's a smallest length possible in physical reality. And you physically, it doesn't make sense to talk about a length smaller than that. It's extremely small, by the way, but you have to assume, well, again, I'm not saying scientists do this exactly. I'm not saying that they necessarily say that the Planck length is the only possible, you know, things that are as big as a Planck length, that's all that is possibly real. I'm not saying they do that. I'm just saying, at some point, you have to say that there is reality. Otherwise, your whole scheme collapses. And science does not like doing this. And this is the problem with models, because this is what models are doing all the time. It's assigning reality to something that is a level removed, that is behind the scenes, that is sort of invisible behind the phenomena. But you see, what if we just model that, and then we model the next thing, and the next thing, and the next thing? Where do you stop? None of it has any reality according to your model or according to your need to model things. I'm not saying my solution to this problem is quite simple. It's that we stop trying to reduce things down. A human is a human. They might have molecules in them, which might be made of atoms, which might be made of subatomic particles, but that doesn't make a human subatomic particles. No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't, because you cannot understand a human by understanding subatomic particles. It's so obvious, but this is literally like how science runs, and this is how models and explanations run. As I've mentioned already in this episode, models impose causal structures. So again, what I just mean by this is that in models, usually there is like there's causality implicitly or explicitly sort of defined within the model. It's like A causes B or B causes C, or, you know, A, B and C cause D, or, and then that causes E and F, you know. There's, you know, it's like arrows and this causes this and this causes the next thing. It's like there's always causality involved. But you see, as we spoke about last week, the issue of causality is a very delicate philosophical problem, right? And often science assigns causes to things based on the materialist paradigm, based on physicalism. So it'll give the initial first cause will be you know, something that can be measured, or it can be something that is physical, that science believes to be physical, or it, you see, it's like, it's not that, it's not just that it tries to define causality, when causality is actually a tricky notion that has been debated by for hundreds of years by philosophers. It's that it's very picky about what it decides to call a cause. You know, in the example of getting scared, you know, science maybe wouldn't say, well, it wouldn't give the reason to something simple like you're scared of spiders because you saw your parents getting scared of spiders when you were younger. No. Science would say, well, okay, that happens, right, yeah, that happens. But really what's happening is it's the brain. It's like, yes, you get scared because it was socially programmed into you from a young age to get scared of this thing, when really there's no reason to be scared of it, like an objective level. But, yeah, okay, right, but really the fear is just brain activity, you know. Even your mum and dad's fear, that was just brain activity. And the whole thing, really, we can just explain it with brain activity, right? That's just that is a bias. So you see, so it's not just the bias for causes, it's that the causes that science chooses are very, like, it's the brain, or it's biology, or it's the laws of physics, or it's this, you know, it's like, there's always a dogmatic answer involved. It's like, why do things fall from, you know, if I throw a burger out of a skyscraper, don't ask me why I'm choosing this example. If I throw a burger out of a skyscraper, why does it fall to the ground? And you say, oh, it's the laws of gravity. No, it's not. The laws of gravity are conceptual descriptions of something that is happening, right? The burger falling, that is conceptual description of why that is happening. It doesn't mean that the laws of gravity cause that. It doesn't mean that gravity causes it, because gravity is a concept as well, right? You see the problem here. And I'm not saying we don't need to describe why, you know, on a certain way we can say, well, yeah, gravity causes a burger to fall from a skyscraper if we throw it out the window. But we need to be careful with this, because in more applied examples, when we're talking about human psychology, we're talking about behavior, we're talking about our emotions and spirituality and so on, if we just assign everything to a physical cause, it's this law, or it's that theory, or this discovery, well, maybe you're wrong about that, you see. Models constrain and bias perception. And this just, it follows on from what I was saying here, that whenever we, you know, models in science, even just on like the level of, well, listen, if you're going to come up with a new model, your colleagues are operating within the scientific paradigm. The people that are funding you, or the people that are deciding where your funding is going, those people are working from the scientific paradigm, from materialism, from physicalism, from naive realism, etc., etc. And so it constrains what the model can describe and how it will describe the thing. Because it's not just, you've not got free rein to just create a model and, you know, come up with descriptions using any old paradigm. No, you're using the scientific paradigm. And once you need to use that paradigm to create your model, well, everything else is then just getting, everything else comes from that. You see, the whole modeling process is built on that, right? And so you're locked into it. And it's not only that this literally just, it constrains how you're even seeing the phenomenon. Because you see someone getting scared and immediately you're thinking about the brain circuitry involved. Whereas actually the brain circuitry might just be a factor. It might not even be that important, but you're locked into that paradigm. So, and you need to build a model because your lab is getting paid $2 million to make some new discovery about how fear works for some pharmaceutical company. So you have to look at the brain phenomena, and you have to look at the mechanisms, and you have to, you know, narrow down the receptors involved, and you see, it's like the whole thing is then limited by the entire paradigm that the where the money's coming from, where the, you know, where you're who's signing the dotted line at the end, you know, who's putting a stamp on the thing. It's like all of it is biased, and it's not even just that the model becomes biased, it's that you become biased and you're not able to see things in a different way. Another critique of models is that when we use models all the time, and theories and discoveries and the laws of science and so on, we start to confuse reality with our models. You know, like, if I can predict, if I throw this this burger out of a window, if I can predict that in 5 seconds it will hit the ground, and indeed in 5 seconds it hits the ground, then all of a sudden I'm not going to see anymore the fact that it's just a burger falling to the ground. What I'm actually going to be seeing the whole time is my model of it, and I'm going to be seeing, well, it's because of this equation, it's because of gravity's 9.81 meters per square second, and because blah 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 blah, right? So, and then the reality of it becomes secondary, and the model actually starts to take on its own reality. And then a step further, models then become dogma, and then we filter everything through them. So we start saying, well, things like, the burger is falling because of Newton's laws. It's not that the burger is just falling, it's falling because of those laws, right? No, it's not. The laws are concepts, they're descriptions of the burger falling. They do not replace the burger falling. But scientists, they are so wrapped up in models that they cannot see that their models are not the actual thing that are being described, and they simply confuse reality for models, and they speak in terms of models. You know, it's like, oh, well, our theories say this, and our laws say this, and this discovery and this paper say this, right? But that's not the actual thing itself. You see, that is your like your conceptual frameworks and your conceptual fog, and you're filtering reality, and you're assuming that it needs to be explained. And again, in some contexts, this might be useful, and it might be necessary, completely necessary. But in other ways, it might be completely backwards and completely faulty. And here's another point I want to make before we wrap up, is that effective action doesn't require explanatory models. So, for example, right, riding a bicycle. I bet that if you spoke to like an engineer or a physicist or even a biologist, they could give you all kinds of equations and theories and laws that are somehow related to the act of riding a bicycle. But when you're riding a bicycle, what do you learn? Do you learn, you know, mathematical laws and calculus and so on? No. You don't learn that. In fact, most of your learning is not conceptual at all. It's done by feel and by experience and by balance and by learning how to use your body from the inside. There's no theory, there's no concepts involved. Things like cooking as well, you know, when you're cooking, you don't think about the fact, when I fry a mushroom, then this chemical reaction's happening, and then this is getting released, and, you know, the proteins in the mushroom are being transformed, and this and that, and the next thing. No. And the best chefs in the world do not need conceptual models to tell them how to cook things, right? Because that is not what is required. What is required is an experiential learning is required. And even things like social interaction. You know, you could have all the models in the world, like neurology, biology, sociology, physiology, psychology. You have all these models in the world, but you could have no idea how to socialize with people. No idea. You could be sitting there, churning over all these theories in your mind. Oh, well, what does this theory say I should do? Oh, I'm feeling this emotion. Why is this happening? What region in my brain is activating? Oh, well, that person looked at me. What does this mean? Let me consult my fucking huge textbook on psychology to let me decipher what that means. No, that is not how you learn how to socialize. Now, of course, these things can be helpful, but ultimately they don't replace the act of socialization, and they are not socialization. Why am I saying this? Because as I mentioned earlier in the episode, there's a huge gap between concept and like pragmatic action and reality, right? And scientists will have all sorts of theories about things. And, you know, for example, they could be scared to death of like a spider or something. They could be the best brain scientists in the world. And they say, oh, well, this region of my brain is activating and this chemical is being released and, oh, my body's tensing up and blah, blah, blah. That doesn't make them any more equipped to deal with the fact that they're scared of spiders. It doesn't make them any more equipped at all. It just makes them more lost in concepts. Why am I saying this? Because if you're really attached to science and you're really attached to conceptual description in any of its forms, what you have to realize is that it's really irrelevant if you're actually like, when it comes down to it, what do you do? When it comes to like the life situation, what happens? You see, your models don't actually matter very much. And that's where I'm particularly interested as, you know, a teacher of psychology and spirituality and a writer, and, you know, really obsessed with like human behavior and human psychology. Like, understanding yourself really comes down to like the day-to-day. What are you doing day-to-day? Like, what are your day-to-day habits? What are your behaviors? How are you thinking? How are you seeing the world? What are your assumptions? All of this stuff, your whole mind laid out, not in your best moments, not in a textbook, not of what some guru said to you, what is like the actual reality of it? And that is where the learning happens, and that's where the real change happens. And models take us away from that. And it takes scientists away from that. It takes us all away from that. As soon as we're lost in concepts, we are removed from reality. And reality does not wait around for us to understand it conceptually. So what's my conclusion here? Is to realize that models are useful, and science is not going to stop using models just because I say so, nor should it, and nor should you stop learning things necessarily. But you have to realize that models are not reality, they're concepts. By definition, they're descriptions, they're conceptual descriptive frameworks about things, right? That describe phenomena. They're not reality. They never are, and they never will be, because reality is not, you cannot capture reality in concepts. And just to notice how attached you are to models, like if you're a scientific person, or even if you're like a psychologist, or you're a therapist, or you're a spiritual practitioner, look how attached you are to models and like explanations for things. What are your go-to explanations for things? Like, what is your knee-jerk reaction? Like, if someone comes to you and, or if you're trying to understand depression, what is like your go-to explanation of that? Is it because of brain activity? Is it because of society? Is it because of diet? Is it because of behavior? Is it because of thought patterns? What theories are you using? Whose thoughts are you referring to? Like, what expert are you referring to? See this bias within you. Because nothing is as simple as one theory or one model. Now, of course, one theory or one model might be very useful, but it's never enough. And often we cling to things because we search for simplicity that actually isn't there. And we are attached to our models and our theories and our concepts. And really, it's just so that you can hold your concepts and your knowledge more lightly and realize that it can be helpful and it can be useful, but it can also constrain you badly, and it can also just detach you from reality completely. So if you've enjoyed this episode, I would advise you to go and listen to my previous two long form episodes this month, my April the 1st episode, which is really just an introduction to the philosophy of science, and my April the 8th episode, which is about why correlation is an explanation, and we're looking carefully at causality there, especially in the area of brain science. Just want to say that this is part of my philosophy episode series, which you can access that full series via the homepage of my website, deep-psychology.com. Scroll down to my categories section or follow the link in the description. You might want to explore my entire 200 episode podcast library. Again, on the homepage, scroll down, you'll see about 15 different categories there. And you might also be interested in signing up to my newsletter, which is just a fortnightly update of what I'm doing, both sort of my professional life and in my personal life. I don't spam you, I just sort of keep you up to date on my thinking and latest projects, my latest episodes and so on. And my books, you can also find them via the link in my description if you want to go deeper into my work. So remember to join me on Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday for little snippets of this episode, and make sure to subscribe on Apple or Spotify to stay up to date with my latest episodes on Wednesday, Thursday, Sunday and Tuesday. Thanks very much, and I will see you next week for the next installment in my Philosophy of Science series. Take care.